Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm John, and this is our 50th episode. It seems pretty crazy to me that I've now done 50 of these things. It really is just me who's done them, because we've kind of had the revolving co-host thing. But yeah, so 50 episodes in, which seems pretty crazy. If you've listened to all of them, then firstly, thank you. And secondly, what the hell's the matter with you? Actually, a couple of days ago, someone told me that they just started listening to the podcast from the beginning, and we're planning to go all the way through from episode one. So, you know, Anthony, just so you know, I think that's wonderful, and also that you're insane. I can say that. He won't hear this one until, like, 2019 or something. Anyway, it's been a lot of fun. We've had, as you'll know, probably, we've had three regular presenters. As you won't know, we've had now 57 different guests. I actually went to the trouble of counting that. We've heard at various points from the mayors of Greater Manchester and the West Midlands. We've heard from the Radio 6 DJ, Stuart McConey. And we've heard from Neil Codling, the keyboard player from Suede. Another guest, actually, was Benjamin Barber, who's one of the greatest urban theorists of our age, who sadly died earlier this year. We've had messages from people who live or work in cities as far apart as Berlin and Toronto, Rotterdam, Singapore and Lagos. We've also talked more about the English metro mayors than anyone else alive, I suspect, probably including the mayors themselves, which is, you know, that's probably been incredibly entertaining for the 30% of the audience that's international, I'm sure. We've also, I think this is my proudest achievement, we've also managed to turn Labour's unsuccessful Tees Valley mayoral candidate Sue Jeffrey into a meme. So there you go. Best of all, I think, about 30 episodes in, I finally found the noise reduction function on my podcasting software. So that's hopefully made everyone's lives a little bit better. I had some pretty big plans for this episode. You know, 50 is a nice round number. So the original plan was that I wanted to get Stephanie back in. And for a change, rather than reading out your tweets in answer to one of our questions, we thought you could ask us something. We garnered some interesting questions that, you know, maybe we could talk about. And I thought maybe we could do it over a couple of drinks as we get progressively tipsier as the podcast went on, because, you know, that, believe it or not, is also something that someone once asked us to do. And, you know, it felt like quite a nice way of celebrating. We are still planning to do that one, with or without booze, I'm not sure. Just as soon as we can get our diaries to work. But sadly, that's not this week. So instead, I've got a very special guest this week. It's me. Yep, for the 50th episode, I've turned into a megalomaniac, and mine is literally the only voice you're going to hear today. Still listening? Okay, well, you had your chance. A few weeks ago, a group of housing policy types asked me to come in and talk to them about the politics of housing in the wake of the general election. I'm a big fan of my own voice, so I agreed. The discussion that followed happened under Chatham House rules, so unfortunately you won't be able to hear any of that. But my speech didn't, so, you know, I had some time to kill, so here it is. For those who don't know me, which I suspect is many of you, I'm John Elledge. I work at the New Statesman, where I edit our website City Metric, which is about urbanism, cities, maps, and all that kind of cool geek stuff.
I also write for The Guardian and anyone else who'll have me. And housing is one of the things that I'm quite obsessed about, to be honest. It's the New Statesman is a small enough publication that being obsessed about something kind of enables you to become the in-house expert in it, which is kind of a nice thing about working there. I was originally asked to speak for 40 minutes on the general election and housing. That seems a little bit optimistic to me. It's probably about twice as long as any speech I've ever given, at least five times as long as anyone will actually want to listen to me. So I figure I'll talk for maybe 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll just kind of have a more general chat. I'm going to talk about the sort of politics and the political environment rather than kind of getting into detailed stuff about Grenfell or whatever. The first thing to say is, so I've never actually been like a proper housing reporter. I've not like done 4 years at Inside Housing or some such. I think the reason I became interested in housing is because I'm one of those awful people who owns their own flat because of a combination of inheritance and a generous mother. You know, being an only child has kind of worked in my favour here. And I think my growing obsession with housing stems from the fact I feel quite a lot of guilt about that. And so the low-level shame that, mixed with irritation that in this day and age, that's kind of the only way of getting on the housing ladder in London, unless you're an investment banker or a corporate lawyer or some such. All of which would explain why it became a topic of interest to me only in about 2013, after I was already a homeowner. And I found myself getting increasingly irritated with the way my generation was struggling with this issue, and I could see those coming up behind me had it a lot worse than us. So over a couple of years, I wrote a series of increasingly shouty blogs on the subject. I think I write best when I'm angry. So in 2015, I found myself sharing a panel with Alok Sharma, long before he was housing minister, after which he told me he found me much less scary than he expected, which is a victory of sorts, I suppose. I was approached by a literary agent about maybe writing a book about housing. And we went through four or five drafts of that. I'm talking to various editors. The only bit I ever actually wrote was the introduction, in which I talked a lot about, I don't know if anyone was at the Homes for Britain rally in March 2015, the National Housing Federation event in the run-up to the general election. I was sat in the front row, which is where they like to put the journalists for these things, which is a terrible decision because it always means the most bored-looking people in the room are sat right at the front staring at Twitter. This is a huge event with, you know, probably a couple of thousand people there in Westminster Central Hall. There was a community choir. There was a steel band, probably about 10 feet from my head. But the kind of star attraction was they got all the politicians from all the major parties to come and give their pitch, basically. So Nigel Farage got booed. Probably more embarrassing than that, Grant Shapps actually got laughed at. And, you know, all this was part of this campaign, the aim of which was to get politicians to make a commitment to solve the housing crisis within a generation. I don't know if anyone can see the problem with setting that as a goal. It's quite easy to get politicians to commit to solving a problem within the next 30 years because they're all gone. They can't. It's too long a time scale, and it doesn't really help much in the short term. So, I was working on a book proposal. I was very excited about the topic, and I kind of thought maybe this was the moment we were finally going to deal with this. But none of the big parties in 2015 made a remotely serious offer on housing. A couple of them quoted some quite big numbers for house building targets, but, you know, without any sort of policy to back that up, obviously they might as well have been promising free unicorn egg for every voter. It's just completely meaningless, right? What was worse from the perspective of both that rally and my own literary ambitions was that out there in the world, nobody much seemed to care very much about the housing issue. I remember there was a YouGov poll which put it at something like sixth, I think, on the list of voter concerns, which was, that's significantly up from earlier elections, but it's still way down below the topics that actually dominate general elections. So it wasn't the housing election, and I couldn't sell my book, which, you know, at least I couldn't sell it to anyone willing to pay me enough money to bother to write it. The last rejection slip I had for that was in May 2016, and I felt a bit sad, but also quite relieved. And then a month later, Brexit happened, and suddenly I found myself feeling bloody delighted I wasn't going to be spending the next year of my life working on this book while the world burnt around me. I still thought at that point that we'd get to a point where housing became a significant issue in British politics, but I kind of thought maybe we're a couple of election cycles off. I really need to stop making political predictions because I'm catastrophically bad at them. Because if you look at the results of the 2017 election, I think actually it was a surprisingly big factor in what went on. Steve Aikhurst from Shelter, who the head of policy I'm sure many of you will know, wrote us a very good blog digging through the stats in the election result, looking at how people in different tenures had voted. A couple of numbers that are worth picking out. The Tories have consistently led polls among homeowners for, you know, as long as anyone can remember, right? That's baked in. But if you look at private renters, they've seen their position collapse. In 2010, the Tories still led Labour in that demographic by 6 points, which is, you know, that's almost surprising in retrospect, but the Tories were winning the private renter vote in 2010. By 2015, they were trailing Labour by 11 points. Last month, they were trailing Labour by 23 points. We headlined the blog, "Did Renters Cost Theresa May Her Majority?" And, you know, there's an unwritten rule in journalism that any headline with a question mark in it, the answer will be no. I think we actually broke that rule because I'm pretty sure that the answer to that question is yes. I think in some ways I was kind of surprised. I mean, a lot of people, I think, expected the Tories to get ahead of this one because, you know, they've historically been so big on home ownership that we kind of optimistically thought maybe they would pull their finger out. A number of people told me they'd expected a big offer on housing to appear in the Tory manifesto. That never materialised. There was very little in there. And, you know, I don't think housing really swung the election because Labour's offers were also pretty weak. And also, let's be honest, no one out there is voting based on land use policy. That's just not what people get het up about. And I don't think we're even close to the point where the government, any government really, is going to start coming forward with serious plans to fix the shortfall in housing numbers. Because if such plans were easy or cheap or politically cost-free, we would have already done them. In the short term, almost anything you can do to address the housing shortage is going to be a vote loser, right? You can't review the Greenbelt, you can't review house height restrictions, you can't rebuild a council estate. Any one of those policies is going to create a lot of angry people long before anyone actually benefits from them. So I fear that proper solutions to the housing supply crisis are in the short term a net vote loser. And, you know, this is without even getting into the buy-to-let bubble and the fact that any significant reduction in house prices, even if we did know how to achieve that, we'd be swapping a housing crisis for a pensions one. So I still think an actual proper fix to this problem is a long way off. But I do think resentment caused by generational inequality is starting to make itself known. My sense is we've kind of hit the limit of the electoral strategy of offering goodies for older people while telling the young, sorry, there's no money left, it's austerity for you guys. There needs to be some kind of offer for young voters. There is a widespread sense, I think, that old people have been coddled in recent elections and young people have been screwed. I think the most visible manifestation of the anger about this so far is the debate over scrapping tuition fees, which, you know, if you look at it from sort of a wonkish perspective, it's obviously a really stupid way of spending 12 billion quid. And yet it has enormous amounts of support because there's so much anger about the inequality. But I think all this is part of a much bigger problem, which is that the implicit contract of capitalism, certainly British-style capitalism, is that if you work hard, you can have nice things. And that's not really been true recently. And, you know, it, in a lot of the country, it doesn't matter how hard you work, you're probably still not going to attain a basic level of security that your parents' generation could take for granted. And I don't think the political class have entirely woken up to this, even now. A housing campaigner once told me that they'd had real problems getting anyone in Westminster to take the plight of renters seriously, because they still have this idea that renters are students or people in their early 20s who live in house shares, and there's no point doing anything for them because in a couple of years they're all going to buy houses and become homeowners and probably vote Tory. And so, you know, that is a problem that will solve itself just as people get older. That's not true anymore. Especially in the South, a lot of renters now are over 30. Some of them are married, many of them have kids. And this is a new phenomenon in recent British political history. And the government is still completely ignoring these guys. There was another stat that's been doing the rounds over the last week from, I think it's the LSE, who drew it out of the English Housing Survey, I think. In 1993, the number of 20-somethings who owned their own home was 50%. 2 decades later, we're down to 20%. Among 30-somethings in 1993, 70% owned their own home. By 2013, it had fallen to under half. My colleague Stephen Bush the other day tweeted, why on earth do these millennials vote for Corbyn? It's a real free pipe problem. It's just, it's blindingly obvious why young people are annoyed and are not voting Tory in droves. And I don't think the party has really woken up to that. I think so far there's a lot of frustration that they're voting for Jeremy Corbyn and his magic money tree. And there's this sort of unspoken, or occasionally actually spoken out loud, idea that young people are voting for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party because they're a bit stupid, because they don't remember the 70s, they don't know what's going on. And actually, I think if you look at it from a rational economic self-interest point of view, there may not be a good argument to vote Labour, but there are certainly very good arguments if you're 25 not to vote Conservative. If I was a Tory, though, the figures that would be keeping me awake at night are those which show that people in their 30s and even 40s are still voting for Labour more than Tories. And, you know, that's obviously not entirely about housing. There's all sorts of other stuff in there, the stuff about austerity, the cuts to public services, just Brexit's probably in the mix. There's all sorts of stuff. But I don't think the party can entirely address that without addressing the housing problem. They need to come up with an offer, not necessarily magically increasing ownership as they kind of once sort of prided themselves on, but, you know, an offer that makes housing more available and more secure to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it. The easiest thing to do on that score, I think, would probably involve sorting out the private rental sector. I don't think rent caps are a very sensible option for all sorts of reasons, but I think there are things they can do around regulation of landlords, longer tenancies, just generally making the private rented sector cheaper and more secure, and just, you know, a kind of place that you could raise a child in the private rented sector, which at the moment is just almost impossible because you never know when you're going to be priced out. You never know, you might be forced to pull the kids out of school. It's just a very disruptive tenure to raise a family in, and I think that needs to change. I think I'm still getting the sense from the Conservatives, certainly, that they're still shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, what can you do? And I think if they want to win an election, with a majority at least, that's probably not electorally sustainable. So maybe we will see some kind of offer on renting in the next few years. Whether anyone has the nerve to tackle the broader supply problem, or the supply problem is obviously part of an even bigger problem, which is the fact that in one half of the country we have jobs and the other half we have affordable housing, and it's very difficult bringing those two together. That's a much harder challenge, so I'm much less convinced we're going to see any serious action on that one coming through anytime soon. But I think maybe we will finally see something on rents this term. We'll see. You will notice I've...
You say that's meaning...
The private rental sector. Yeah. You'll notice I've not really mentioned Grenfell at all, and I'm kind of tacking that on as a sort of epilogue to my sort of rant about electoral politics. Partly I've been avoiding it because I feel we are still getting to the bottom of this and I'm a bit scared of misspeaking. Partly because it rapidly descends into matters of, you know, building regulation and housing revenue accounts, which I don't really feel massively qualified to talk about. And frankly, you guys will all know far more about it than I do. So I don't want to get into the specifics, but it clearly is a very big moment for the housing debate. I think just the whole symbolism of dozens of people dying in a fire brought on by poor quality public housing in the richest borough, in the richest city in this country, is just beyond horrifying. Like, the moment that really got to me, I have to say, was when they said they won't even have a full body count till the end of the year. That's just... It's not even that the guys who died in there are statistics, it's that there are absence of statistics. And that's just terrifying. It feels like an awful symbol of both, you know, economic inequality and government ineptitude. And I think there are going to be whole books written about this moment. But, you know, a couple of quick thoughts on the political impact of that, I think, and things that might change. Firstly, I feel like one of the big stories of the last 40 years in housing has been the state withdrawing from the housing debate. You know, obviously, as you all know, once upon a time, the state was a major builder and, you know, the major landlord, And housing was kind of, it was one of the main things councils were for, right? Like, if you were a visionary architect in the 1960s and you wanted to reshape the world, going to work for a council housing department was not a crazy thing to do. And that's just all gone. Like, councils have stopped building, not in large part not because they chose to, but because they've been forced to. And that has had a massive impact on the fact we now have a chronic undersupply in housing. And worse than that, I think the Grenfell tragedy highlights the fact that even the stuff they're still supposed to be doing, they don't really see it as part of their job. Or at least some councils don't. Obviously, the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea has one of the worst records on this score. If you just look at the number of houses they've built recently, I think it's, in the last decade, I think I'm right in saying it has the third worst record in the country. And they might say, well, you know, we're very densely populated. And yeah, but so is Islington and Tower Hamlets, and they've both managed more. It just looks like they didn't see housing their residents and making sure they had a decent quality of housing was their job. These guys are sat on a fortune, and they've been crimping on stuff like the cladding, and it's just sick-making, you know? That leads me on to my second point on it, which is I think we've been... In fact, I've been doing it in this speech so far. We ignore social housing as a tenure, as a point for discussion. Housing has risen up the agenda in the last few years. It's discussed a lot more in politics and in the press now than it was in 2010, for example. But when we talk about housing, we tend to talk about house prices. We may now talk about how house prices going up forever is bad rather than good, but we still talk about house prices. Or, you know, at a push, we talk about bad private landlords. And I think this reflects who is taking part in this debate. It's the fact, you know, we're talking about housing more now because it's having a knock-on, it's having a direct effect on the chattering classes, and the fact there are now people in quite prominent roles in politics or the media who still can't get on the housing ladder, who are still subject to the whims of a landlord, and that wasn't true 10 years ago. So I think that's why it's come to the fore. But we're still not talking about the sixth of the population living in social housing. That is still going completely under-discussed. And as I said a moment ago, I am aware I am as guilty of this as anyone, and I feel slightly embarrassed I don't know more about the technical side of social housing than I do. But at least I'm not the new head of the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea who just said she's never been in a tower block, which is, you know, that's kind of shocking, but I very much doubt she's alone in public life in being able to say that. Lastly, I feel like we have no language for talking about the right to be in a place that isn't about literally owning it. We've financialised housing to such an extent that when we talk about it, we talk about house prices, and we talk about housing as an asset. We don't talk about it as public infrastructure or a part of the public services. I think this has undermined our sort of notion of place. So the idea of a home becomes about... The idea of a right to a home, rather, is about what you can afford rather than where you were born or where you live. Already in the Grenfell debate, we're starting to see people, mostly, thankfully, not politicians, but we are starting to see people questioning why the survivors should have the right to remain in Kensington. And the logic is, well, I couldn't afford this. Why should they have this? Yeah, this feels pretty sick, because obviously we're talking about the survivors of an absolutely horrific tragedy, probably brought on by government neglect. But it's an argument I think we hear many times in many different contexts that kind of dominates the housing debate. I think the fact that getting private housing in London has become so expensive and so difficult has weakened the argument for subsidised public housing. It has made it much harder to make the case that people do have a right to be in the place they were born. They do have a right to stay near their family. I hope that maybe this is a moment where we kind of finally own up to the fact this is not a sustainable position, especially not in London, because there will always be people who need housing in London but can't afford London house prices. I don't think it's reasonable to expect all our nurses or retail workers in the city to commute in from Luton or the Medway towns. We have to be making an offer for them too. So, in conclusion, I kind of think we need to change how we talk about housing. We need to stop talking about social housing as the inferior option. And we need to change how we view a council's role and how they view their residents. I think it would be useful if they could see their residents as customers and voters again, not just kind of these annoying people they kind of have to do the minimum for. And I stand by my now fairly long-term position, which is that if we're ever going to really get out of this mess, I think the state needs to get its hands dirty and start building again. Because I mean, it's abundantly clear by now that if the market was going to provide, it would have already done it. If the market weren't, the government must. Thank you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, it's me again, just for a change. As I said before that speech, there was a discussion afterwards conducted under Chatham House rules, which means we can't really report any of it. But in the name of fairness, I should say that several of the housing policy experts in the room did question some of the reporting of Kensington and Chelsea's role in all this. The consensus was that the Borough Council has been pretty disastrous in the aftermath, that they didn't handle it well, but there was a feeling actually that maybe some of the stories of neglect have been overdone, and that actually there are a lot of people in the council, both elected members and the officials, who care a lot more for their residents than they've been given credit for. And also that the new leader of Kensington Council, who I mentioned in passing there for her comments that she's never been inside a tower block, there was actually some faith that she's a decent, committed public servant. And you know, these, to be clear, these were not this was not a room full of Tories. These were often people from the political left, I think, but they just felt some of the media coverage, which I was basing many of my comments on, had been a little unfair. I just thought it was worth owning up to that. Incidentally, another idea I had for our 50th podcast was to get both Stephanie and Barbara back, and also a third person who we would pretend to have been a co-host, even though they never actually had been. That's a pretty niche joke, but you know, I thought I'd throw it in for the four or five of you who may like that. Anyway, I didn't ask Twitter a question this week, but what I did do is I told them I'd be presenting alone, and I suggested that they tweet me interesting things to read out, because, you know, what could possibly go wrong with that as a strategy? First up, there's longtime Skylines listener Julia, who tweets as Angry Sigh. She asked me a whole bunch of questions, actually. She asked me my favourite articles, what the worst thing I've ever written was, what I would do to fix the British transport system, who the hottest mayor was. She wanted me to rank the hotness of mayors. I might actually get Stephen Bush back on at some point so we can argue about that one. But anyway, eventually I told Julia that really I just wanted some jokes. She said, I'm quoting now, "Oh, okay. Die, bitch, I hate you." So, you know, thanks for that, Julia. She did also write a fantastic article for us a couple of weeks ago on the history of our home city of Rio de Janeiro, by the way, which you should really read that. It's a really great piece.
What else have we got? My wife Sarah wrote in to say, shall I call in and heckle you? Which I sort of pretended I hadn't seen that one. Ben B, who tweets in Cinema Shoebox, asks, John, why haven't you ranked the nuts-free regions yet? John, that's a good question. Well, this is quite a good one. Schroduck, which is, you know, like Schrodinger, but with a duck. Schroduck points out that creating the West of England combined authority on top of the existing mayoralty means that the South West now has a large pair of Bristols. Yep, yep, that happened. But yeah, here's a nice one. I think at the end of a nice one. Andy Walton writes, John, you big podcast loner, if it wasn't for your obsessive love of tube maps, I'd have far more time on my hands. Happy 50th. So, you know, thanks, man. That means a lot. Anyway, we've got a lot more stuff planned. I've already taped some of this, by the way, so I can tell you definitively that things we're going to be talking about in the upcoming episodes include city-states, air pollution, the problems faced by the cities of Africa. Also hoping to do a joint episode, or maybe even two, with an American transport podcast called The Overhead Wire, which I haven't got that on tape yet because I keep failing to sort it out. So sorry, Jeff, we will get that one sorted. And yes, if all goes to plan, then at some point soon, Stephanie will come back for the odd episode. And yeah, so it's exciting times, really. But, you know, I do say this a lot, but I mean it. Please do, you know, you're all listening out there. Please write in to tell us what you want us to be talking about, or rather what you want me to be talking about at this point. Especially if you're one of the minority of our listeners outside Britain and the United States. I kind of want to know, well, firstly, I kind of want to know why you're listening at all, but I would just like to hear from you and your views on the podcast and what we should be talking about. I'm really easy to contact. I'm on Twitter as @JohnEllidge, which is, my name is impervious to accurate spelling, so I'll just spell it out for you. It's JohnEllidge. It's the double N that tends to throw people. I'm also on Facebook as John Elledge Writes. And if you Google, you can find at least three different emails for me, which is a bit depressing. It kind of removes the mystique, doesn't it? But there we are. One last thing. If you could leave us a review on iTunes, or even just tell your friends, help us spread the word a little bit, because, you know, we'd like more people listening to this podcast. I think there's probably more people already listening to this podcast than in many ways that this podcast actually deserves. But, you know, I'm building an empire here. I'd like more. So go on, help us out. You'd be doing me a favour. So, yeah, that's the show. That's the John Elledge special. Sorry about that. Next week, I promise, I will have some other people on again. It won't just be me. And, yeah, I mean this sincerely. Thanks for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.